It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, election security efforts heading into 2020 hit a roadblock this week when Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and a Republican colleague blocked a pair of bills that would fund security initiatives. We'll learn more in just a bit. First, let's say you've got some friends coming over, or maybe the in-laws, or you've just been planning a special get-together for months to celebrate a birthday, a holiday, or just for the heck of it. Here's the question. What is the one go-to meal in your cooking arsenal? We're celebrating the dishes today that we rely on to impress our friends and family members and to fill our enemies with awe and envy. You can share your go-to meal at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. Judith Sears Poisson joins me for this week's edition of Food Friday. She's executive producer of Central Time. Judith, hey.
Hey, good to be here.
It's been a few minutes since I saw you last.
I know. Great to see you, Rob.
Do you have one of these, like that thing that you make, like, okay, this is where I want to make the good stuff?
So it's funny. It is not a fancy recipe, but people love
it.
It looks great. So it's, I know this is going to sound very something. It's a kale salad,
okay.
But it's a dressing that really makes it. It's actually a nutritional yeast dressing. It's equal parts of, soy sauce, apple cider vinegar, and water. And then you've got a lot of fresh garlic, also canola oil, and nutritional yeast, and you just blend it up. You massage the kale with it, so it helps the acidity in the vinegar helps to break it down.
And you're a licensed kale masseuse.
I am a licensed kale masseuse. But the thing that kind of dresses it up a little is it goes incredibly well with salmon.
Ooh.
And so you can even, I know it's a little sacrilegious, but you can actually use canned salmon and just kind of chunk it up. Or if you just, you know, broil a nice piece of salmon, lay it on top of the kale salad, it looks beautiful. And it tastes so well, so good. And it can sit a little while because the kale doesn't break down that fast.
All right. That sounds great. Now, how about you? Do you have a go-to recipe that you make maybe for a special someone or a would-be special someone when you have a big group, a small group, somebody you want to impress? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We heard from Lynn on the Ideas Network Facebook. Lynn says, this time of year, I love doing pulled pork on the grill. We like to smoke/roast. Is that a thing? I don't know. For 3 hours and then in the oven for 3 hours, coleslaw on top and chips. And Lynn says they sit and look at the lake while they do it. That sounds great. Now, I've gotten a couple lately that I've gotten just off the interwebs. A shawarma style chicken.
It's
I talk about this thing all the time. But people love it. People love it. And I can do it in the oven, on the grill. You blend up the spices, the cumin, and all the stuff, marinate it for a while, and it cooks up really good.
Can I say that I have challenged you before to a chicken shawarma cook-off, and you have yet to pick up the gauntlet there.
That's true. So we got to do this.
I've
got a new one. I found a recipe. I have all this cilantro, right? Because it's, you know, you get it from the CSA, you get it at the store. Do you ever get a tiny bit of cilantro? No, you end up with a whole bunch. So I'm like, what can I do with this? I looked online for a cilantro sauce. I'll talk you through this one. It's really easy. You take your bunch of cilantro, chop it up, and then you throw it in the blender with a blob of olive oil. What else? A couple garlic cloves, a little vinegar. I think there's vinegar in it. And that's about it. There's one more thing.
You could probably also do lemon juice instead of the
lime
vinegar.
Lime juice. There you go. That's what it is. You squeeze that lime, full lime, blend it. And then I put in a little blob of mayonnaise at the end and stir it together. And I literally just invited people over to a thing. And one of them immediately responded, are you going to have cilantro sauce?
Wow.
So it's a hit. It was an instant hit.
So wait, what do you put the sauce on?
Whatever. You put it on tacos.
I could see it on meat, yeah.
Veggie dip. Tacos, veggie dip, bean dip. Yeah, anything. It's really good. Let's bring in a caller now. Mary is with us in Pewaukee. Mary, hi.
Well, hi. You kind of caught me while I'm just kind of writing things down because I didn't know I'd be calling in. And this is a great thing to make in a crock pot. So it's basically easy because you're throwing everything together. You're heating it up in the crock pot. Although I do like to saute my onions. I always like to saute the onions ahead of time and maybe some garlic. Okay. So what it is this four bean. It's not a salad, but it's a dish. It's a potluck or a crock pot dish. And it's a side dish, but you can add ground beef. Some people probably are familiar with this already. with the four different beans would be like a big can of pork and beans, and then I add butter beans, lima beans, and then kind of your choice if you like black beans and chili beans. And then you put some spices in there. You add in the sauce to make it all kind of marinate together. Mm-hmm. Is ketchup, Worcestershire sauce, brown sugar, a little bit of vinegar. So the vinegar and the brown sugar kind of, you know, sweet and sour. And a couple of different spices. Depending on how spicy you like it, you might want to throw in some sriracha, a little bit of cayenne, and you kind of go from there. I don't even measure it. I just kind of go by taste.
That sounds great. And Mary, is this something that people are looking for? And if you don't make it, like, Mary, where's the bean thing?
Yeah, I hope they're saying that. Yeah, it's really good for a big party. If you have a larger crock pot, awesome. And then it freezes really well, too.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that with us, Mary, at 800-642-1234. We're asking for your go-to dishes when you want to make something you know is going to be a hit for whoever you're cooking it for.
And our producer, our Central Time producer, Dean Kinnetter, little known fact, used to be a cheesemonger.
True.
And so he says, you know, it's a done deal for him. He always brings the cheese plate. And I have to say, people with my French connections expect a cheese plate. And, you know, it can be really impressive with very little effort on your part. The things that you want to know about a cheese plate are, you want a soft cheese, so often like a brie or a camembert or something like that. You want a blue cheese, mm-hmm. So a little blue. And then you want something that has a hard rind, so anything like a Gruyere or an Emmental. Petit Basque is a really nice one. I brought that recently. And then, you know, besides crackers, I actually like to put a couple like edible flowers or nasturtiums are great. Or I just did a cheese plate for Bastille Day, big surprise. And because all the cheeses were kind of the same beige, I actually put some black and red currants, just a couple little sprigs from my garden in the middle, and it looked beautiful.
It sounds great. Forget that chicken shawarma contest. I want you and Dean to have a cheese plate.
The cheese throwdown.
Yes. I think, you know, we could have our own cooking show. Like where we have like dueling dishes.
Wow, no one's ever done that.
No, true. How about you? Do you have a go-to dish that you'd like to make for a special occasion, a special someone, something you know is going to be a hit, maybe for the potluck? Call 800-642-1234. Pat emailed to say, I like to make a fresh coleslaw to go with ribs and asparagus with mushrooms to go with steak or ribs. Any display of meat usually gets a reaction from our guests. That's true, but I think that fresh coleslaw, like having that thing that goes with it, like there's a lot of restaurants mm-hmm. over time where I'm like, yeah, your main dishes are good, but the sides are what keep me coming back.
And especially a coleslaw, if it's got a little bit of bite to it mm-hmm. to really cut the richness of the meat, I think that's especially good. I'm more of a vinaigrette coleslaw than a mayonnaise coleslaw.
And we asked around the office here at WPR. Laura Pavin says she makes a berry trifle. She says it's a healthy dessert that's tasty and that people don't feel that bad about eating calorie-wise. I rarely feel bad about eating a dessert.
Well, and I asked our wonderful on-show director today, Brianne Shossow, to Google for me what is in a trifle. And she said it can be anything, berries, lemon curd, whipped cream, sponge fingers, custard. So I could see how you can make that healthier. Or not, if you don't feel the need.
Sponge fingers?
Like,
isn't that James Bond movie?
No, it's like what goes in tiramisu. Like the
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. Okay, I get it. We are talking with Judith Sears Poisson. She's with me on this edition of Food Friday as we continue to explore go-to dishes that we turn to for maybe a dinner party, a favorite family meal, an occasion where we want to impress somebody. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that one thing that you rely on for those special moments? Or is there something that people are looking at you when they want it at the event? Call in at 800-642-1234. Is there a special memory attached to this? Maybe this is something that came down in your family. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We want to hear from you. What is your specialty dish? What's the thing people ask you to make or that you make for special occasions? Judith Sears Poisson, our executive producer, is in here with me.
I am, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. So let's say you're hosting dinner tonight. having a few friends over, what dish will your guests expect or hope for? What can't they wait for you to make for them again? What do you rely on for the special occasions in your life, like birthdays, game nights, sleepovers, dinner parties? If you've got a go-to dish that is just better than the rest, we want to hear about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
And I've heard from some people, they have the one recipe that's their, like, their date recipe. It's like, I don't cook a lot, but I know how to make this one thing. And, you know, if I'm cooking for somebody, that's what I'm going to make. Maybe you've got one of those. Tell us about it. We'll go back to our callers now. Keith is with us in Winona. Keith, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you got for us, Keith?
I usually go with a small, simple chicken salad. I'll sous vide chicken on probably 145 for about an hour, hour and a half, and then sear the outside chunks. And then I'll put them in a dressing with Greek yogurt, honey, garlic, salt, and pepper over baby spinach with halved grapes and some apple chunks.
Ooh.
Ooh, people pretty impressed by that, Keith, when you make it?
Absolutely.
Awesome.
One and my fiance, so.
One and his fiance. Great. Thank you so much, Keith. Congratulations on that. Maybe you can cook for the reception, too. A sous vide, Judith?
Yeah, it's very low heat, and it's kind of almost vacuum packed.
Huh, okay.
So it's kind of like poaching, but there's a layer in between what you're poaching and the actual poaching liquid.
Gotcha. And then he sears it, mm-hmm, at the end. That sounds fantastic, Keith. Thanks so much. We'll go to John with us now in De Pere. John, hello.
Hello. I must tell you, you guys have one of the best shows.
Thank you.
I was going to say on television, but it's on radio.
You don't want us on television, true. John.
Oh, sure I do. Well, hold it. I'll give you a chance to look at me. So what I really like is the fact that all of your recipes are something that I think a lot of people can use, especially me. And I do most of the cooking in the household. And I have a simple kind of recipe that you started off your show with, and that is the vinaigrette.
Mm-hmm.
And I gave up. I really did. I used to know how to make it. And so I went to the internet and I looked it up, and it's, you know, a simple combination of this vinegar and then you guys added garlic, which I sometimes do. And then your show exploded.
We just blew your mind, John.
Okay. You did. Yeah. Okay. I always add about three grapes. Oh, really? And so I want to tell you, your show is wonderful. I'm 81 years old. If you could go a little slower.
Sure.
Oh, sure.
All right, John, thank you so much. It's very kind words. Run through that vinaigrette a little
sure.
bit for me.
Sure. So
Judith.
It's actually a little different than a standard vinaigrette, but what I do is 1/3 cup each of soy sauce. You can use low sodium. I always do 1/3 cup soy sauce, 1/3 cup water, and 1/3 cup of the apple cider vinegar. That gives it a really nice bite and flavor. And then you want to put in as much garlic as you want. I put way more than most people would, probably 5 or 6 fingers, are they called? Is that what they're called?
Mm-hmm.
Like half a clove, we'll say.
Sponge
half
fingers.
A head. Sponge fingers. And then you want to put 1/2 cup of nutritional yeast, and you can get that bulk in a lot of places. And then, and you're kind of blending at each stage, and then 1 1/2 cups of canola oil, and it, you know, just blended enough so it really holds together. It's a really nice color too, and it's delicious.
Hope that helps you out, and it'll be yummy. And even if you get a little wrong, it's still going to
yes,
be pretty
it's
good.
It's going to be great.
Let's go now to Vicky with us in Spring Green. Vicky, hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good. What's your recipe, Vicky?
Oh, I have a really nice, easy recipe for hummus.
Okay.
I love making blender food, especially in the summer, because there's no cooking involved. And I just measure out, actually open up 2 cans of chickpeas and rinse them real well, put them in a strainer, and then measure out about 1/4 cup of olive oil and 1/4 cup of tahini mixed with some warm water to dissolve it.
And tahini is a sesame seed paste, kind of, right? Isn't it?
Yes, okay. Yes, it is. And you can actually find it in most grocery stores now by the peanut butter or in their ethnic foods mm-hmm. aisle. And I think that, you know, the better quality tahini you use, the creamier your hummus is. You know, there's different brands that have different creaminess. But it's all good. It's the flavor you're after. And then I, you know, mix that up with warm water to dissolve it really well. And then a couple cloves of garlic or however much garlic you think you might like. And then maybe half a lemon or even a whole lemon if you like a little more tartness
sure.
to it. You just throw it all in the blender and blend it up till it's really smooth, you know, depending on how thick or smooth you like it. If it's actually a little runny, that's okay, because as soon as you refrigerate it for a little while, it'll get a little more solid. So you don't want to make it too stiff when
right.
you're, you know, doing it. And you can adjust that with either a little more olive oil or a little more water.
Vicki, thank you so much. It sounds fantastic. That's a great one for parties. Maybe
I
not
love
for,
hummus.
Maybe not for date night, but for reasons. I used to try to make hummus, but I'd like do it from dry beans. I'd make a pound of them and way too much and
yep.
not enough. So it would be like, you know, chips break off because it's so thick. Terrible. I made terrible hummus.
But,
I haven't tried it again since.
Well, yeah. Try it with the canned chickpeas.
I should. I love canned chickpeas.
Let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Mark in Bloomer is up. Hi, Mark.
Hey, I was told that you should always marry somebody who knows how to cook.
I think it's great advice.
Beauty might fade, but you're always going to be hungry.
So it sounds like perhaps you took your own advice.
My wife makes amazing food, pecan balls and spinach pie with phyllo dough.
Oh, yeah.
Tofu. Oh, my gosh. You never seen a guy more in love with his wife than her cooking.
All right, Mark, but I got to ask, did your wife take that same advice? Did she marry someone who knows how to cook?
No. She's a man who can take a clue to stay out of the kitchen.
I'm sure you have other redeeming qualities, Mark.
I hope so.
Mark, thank you so much for that call at 800-642-1234. We're asking for your go-to dish when you want to cook and impress something or make something you know your whole family is going to like, maybe the first time around and in leftover form, something you bring to the big event, whatever. What is that one dish for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
And our Central Time producer, Jay Carlisle Larson, said, my go-to dish is some version of roasted chicken. My favorite basic recipe is Thomas Keller's roast chicken with root vegetables from the cookbook Ad Hoc at Home. And she says if she's feeling fancy, Allison Roman's anchovy butter roast chicken with chicken fat croutons.
Wow.
Whoa, is delicious. She says, don't be afraid of anchovies and definitely put the butter under the skin. Why hasn't she cooked that for us, Rob?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of that doesn't sound like it's going to travel real
know.
Good.
But I think what JC is saying there is, you know, if you do a roast chicken, mm-hmm. it's really impressive and it's easy. It's not hard to do at all, but it has that presentation aspect.
True. Yeah, I like foods that look like they took a lot of effort, but didn't really.
So actually, for a recent brunch, I was trying to figure out an egg dish to make, and all I did was cook egg with salt and pepper in a cast iron skillet and then flipped it out after, and I chopped garlic chives, oregano, basil, and parsley from the garden. Just
wow.
chopped it, sprinkled it on top. It looked great.
Let's go back to our callers. Tom is with us in Windsor. Tom, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I haven't heard anyone bring up breakfast yet. I make a coffee cake that everyone is always wanting.
Ooh.
Oh, you know,
in fact, one of my brother-in-laws has the same size pan I use. And so it's acceptable if I show up at his house with a full pan of coffee cake and
nice.
He gives me an empty pan to take home.
Now, Tom, a coffee cake for me is something I buy. I don't make. How hard is it to make coffee cake?
Oh, it's really easy. It's I don't have the recipe in front of me
sure.
right now. I'm driving. It's flour, and gluten-free flour works wonderful.
Oh.
Baking powder, baking soda, salt, sugar. And then on top of it, after it's all mixed together and put in the pan, you put a streusel topping on top of it and bake it.
That sounds great. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Yeah, it's not even on my radar to make coffee
cake. Made it before. I haven't made it for a while, but especially if it's got sour cream in it, you can't really go wrong with worrying about it getting too dry.
Let's bring in another caller, Roger, with us now in Grantsburg. Roger, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good. What recipe do you have for us, Roger?
Well, I got a one here that Mama makes. It's just a dino, easy one-pan meal. It doesn't take much to make. Chicken breasts, you put four chicken breasts in a pan, saute them with fresh mushrooms, and put fresh spinach leaves, And you get them all nice and sautéed. You put them on a plate, and you're in the pan. You cover them with Munster cheese slices.
That's, and so, is that your meal request every time, Roger?
Well, actually, she pulled it on me, and I'm like, yeah, what's this stuff? You know, yeah, it's not like beef and potatoes here. You know, she's like, well, okay. So we tried it, and I thought, wow. Hey, that's really good.
Fantastic, Roger. Just like Mom makes. Thank you so much for that. Speaking of chicken breast, Cynthia Woodland in our giving department has a chicken salad. She has a secret ingredient, cream cheese. So boiled chicken breast, then some mayo, unchopped onions, fine chopped onions, celery, green grapes, salt, pepper, and then cream cheese. That's interesting because I usually think just the mayo, not
right.
The cream cheese.
Yeah, I could see it giving a little more body. And cream cheese, I really like it. It does have a really nice flavor.
Right, time for another caller. How about Ellen in Broadhead? Ellen, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about, Ellen?
Oh, so we have a gathering coming up this weekend, and my 8-year-old said I have to make German potato salad.
Okay.
And it kind of surprised me. I know she likes German potato salad, but you just don't expect to hear that from an 8-year-old. And if you're not familiar with German potato salad, it's a hot salad,
right?
Right, with a vinegar and sugar base, and has bacon and chives in it, and it takes a little effort to make because you got to, you know, cut up the potatoes and cook them and things like that. But it's great for a large group gathering. And my father-in-law actually said that as long as I made German potato salad and homemade donuts for his birthday, that was all he needed.
Fantastic! So that's all.
Okay. My daughter and my father-in-law happy.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Ellen.
And Ellen, would you like to know our birthdays so you can make donuts and German
Definitely.
Potato
that
salad
sounds,
for us?
I'm in too.
Great. We'll send you the whole team's list.
Well, thank you, everybody, for all the recipes. We also heard from our own Lisa Nalbandi in a classic Armenian dish, cheese bodak with phyllo dough, brick cheese, and butter. Ooh,
oh.
That sounds, I don't know. It sounds simple. It may be hard to come together,
yeah.
But it sounds really good.
It sounds worth the effort. Let's put it that way.
And Keely Boltina from The Morning Show, a dessert, her grandma's brownies. They are not health food. An entire cup of vegetable oil. Come on. But it has memories for her as well. Well, thank you, everybody. You can keep sharing your go-to recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Judith, you inspired?
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, which one of these are you going to make? You're going to make us a German potato salad for Monday.
I am feeling like the German potato salad, yes.
All right. Well, this is Food Friday on Central Time. Again, share your recipes on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up, we'll look at the politics and policy when it comes to election security. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a lot of the pictures or videos that get posted to social media go through a human screening process. We'll find out how content moderators do their work, which involves confronting the dark side of the internet on a daily basis. First, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and a Republican colleague blocked two bills from the House of Representatives this week aimed at making elections more secure heading into the 2020 election year. McConnell objected to the bills, saying they were too partisan and would give Democrats an unfair advantage.
Any Washington involvement in that task needs to be undertaken with extreme care, and on a thoroughly bipartisan basis. Obviously, this legislation is not that. It's just a highly partisan bill from the same folks who spent 2 years hyping up a conspiracy theory about President Trump and Russia, and who continue to ignore this administration's progress at correcting the Obama administration's failures on this subject in the 2018 election.
McConnell's decision to block the bills came after testimony from Special Counsel Robert Mueller, who said that Russians and other countries were actively attempting to undermine the U.S. elections process. Our next guest joins us to talk about the move and how election insecurity could affect voting behavior heading into 2020. Kathleen Dolan is a distinguished professor and chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. Kathleen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, let's touch on the two bills that were blocked here in the Senate. The first one, supported by Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, would have required the use of paper ballots at the polls and increased funding for the Election Assistance Commission. What do you make of the effort to pass that and then the blocking of it in the Senate?
Well, Senator Schumer's bill would have, as you said, required all state and localities to use voting apparatus that have a verifiable paper backup ballot. Currently, there are 14 states in the United States where people vote without any paper record. They simply vote on a touchscreen machine that ostensibly saves votes to, say, a hard drive or a memory, but there's nothing verifiable. In 2018, there were some circumstances around the country, most notably in Georgia, where some voters argued that the voting machines changed their votes. And so there's no way to check on those sorts of things. So that's the first step. One thing that listeners may or may not know is that in the United States, states and localities run elections, and that includes determining the kinds of voting machines or ballot practices that are used in any particular jurisdiction. So within any state in the United States, you can have tens and tens of different ways of voting because localities make all these choices. So Senator Schumer's bill, I think, was designed to at least bring some sense across the 50 states that everybody should be required to have a verifiable paper backup for every vote.
What do you make of Senator McConnell's case, Majority Leader McConnell's case, that this was a partisan bill? Is this something that would have helped or hurt Democrats or Republicans more than the other party?
Having verifiable votes would not necessarily help one party or the other. Senator McConnell's strategy here in suggesting that this is all partisan, I think, is just really a way of signaling to people on his side, you know, some set of reasons he thinks are valid for declining these things. I think the larger, you know, battle here is about the degree to which we have security in elections in the United States, and also importantly, the degree to which the federal government regulates any of the practices that happen in elections in the United States. Because for the largest, you know, segment of decisions that are made, the federal government does not have much involvement.
The other bill, supported by Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, would have required candidates, campaign officials, and family members to notify the FBI if foreign governments offered assistance to their campaigns. Clearly a response to what some of the findings of the Mueller report. Was this a real attempt at a law, or is this kind of a partisan dig here?
I don't think it's a partisan dig. I mean, I think we have to take these things at, you know, the value that the senators suggest that, you know, the reasons for them exist. I mean, we have, you know, myriad pieces of evidence that the Russian government, you know, tried to interfere with the elections, but also approached individual actors, the side of Republican candidates and President Trump, with information about Democratic opponents. So we have precedent that that's happened. We also have had debate for the last couple of years about what was the appropriate way for the Trump campaign and the Republican Party, the National Committee, to have handled that. So this bill, you know, would essentially criminalize the behavior that happened in 2016 when members of the Trump campaign and the RNC did not, you know, do what many people thought they should have done and contacted law enforcement. So given that we know that this has happened, I think this is Senator Blumenthal saying, we know that's a problem, we know we want something moving forward, and clearly campaigns need to be taught that this is not appropriate behavior.
Talking to Kathleen Dolan, political science professor at UW-Milwaukee, about election security, a couple of laws passing the House, blocked by Republicans in the Senate. This also came up during special counsel Robert Mueller's testimony this week. Here he is speaking to Republican Representative William Hurd of Texas. You'll hear Representative Hurd first.
In your investigation, did you think that this was a single attempt by the Russians to get involved in our election, or did you find evidence to suggest they'll try to do this again?
Oh, it wasn't a single attempt. They're doing it as we sit here, and they expect to do it during the next campaign.
We also see a Senate report saying that Russians made efforts to compromise election security in all 50 states. How worried should we be? How worried are people about Russian and other countries attempting to influence our elections through a number of different means, Kathleen?
Well, I think that there's legitimate reason to be concerned. I mean, again, we have significant evidence of their involvement in the 2016 election, and there's no reason to imagine that they have just realized that they, you know, did something wrong and that they're going to stop. I mean, special, you know, independent counsel Mueller yesterday was very clear about that. And I think Homeland Security would suggest that, that the evidence, you know, is that there are still these attempts. The thing about, I think the thing with which people should be most concerned is that there are really very few attempts going on right now to stop these things. I think people could argue there is a role for the federal government to play to assist states to make sure they have the most secure systems in place. I think, you know, having paper verifiable ballots would be at least a start toward that. We have evidence from 2016 that voter registration databases were hacked into. Whether that was done by the Russians or not, those kinds of systems really need to be secure because those could lead to all sorts of chaos on election day if voter registration data become vulnerable and they are a privacy breach, if nothing else. So that sets aside Facebook and social media and the other kinds of interruptions that we know happened as well and that we think are happening moving forward, where the federal government may have less power to regulate the you know, the actions of private businesses like Facebook and Twitter and those sorts of entities. But where the federal government can have a role in helping states, I don't think anybody is suggesting here that we nationalize the administration of elections, but certainly the degree to which the national government has the financial wherewithal to help states update aging infrastructure, update security practices and technologies and be using best practices and update their physical hardware for voting, I think many people would say that that's a reasonable way to make some attempts to make sure our elections are fair.
In just our last 30 seconds or so, Kathleen, how worrisome is the possibility of a close election and the reality and maybe the perception that there was tampering?
I think that that's a real concern. Right now, polling suggests to us that about 55% to 60% of Americans have at least some measure of concern about the security of the 2020 presidential election. Like everything else these days, it is a partisan issue where Democrats are much more concerned than are Republicans. But I think overall people, you know, at least understand that given the evidence of 2016, this is something about which we have to be concerned moving forward.
Kathleen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Kathleen Dolan, Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at UW-Milwaukee. She joins us today to talk about Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's decision to block election security laws that had passed the House and how election security issues could impact voter perception in the 2020 election year. Coming up, we'll find out about the people who screen some of the most problematic content getting put on and taken off of social media and how their jobs affect them. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Marathon County Board voted to keep its designation of June as Pride Month in place. We'll find out about the debate surrounding that decision as part of our state news roundup. Now, people upload hundreds of thousands of videos and pictures to social media sites every day, and as those platforms have grown, so is the need for people to regulate what's getting submitted. Those people, known as content moderators, are tasked with taking down things like graphic violence and sexual material before they reach our screens. Our next guest took a deep dive into how that process works and how it shapes what we see online. Sarah Roberts is an assistant professor of information studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She was born and raised here in Wisconsin. Her new book is called Behind the Screen, Content Moderation in the Shadows of Social Media. She talked to Central Time producer Dean Kinetter earlier today.
Why did content moderation strike you as something really important and worth traveling the world to research?
I think when I first became aware of this practice, which was almost 10 years ago now, I myself had been on the internet at that point for almost 20 years. I had also worked in technology, and I was doing a PhD in the area. And the fact that I had never heard of the practice, its total absence in any conversation to which I'd ever been a party, it led me to think that that it was actually being hidden. So that fact, coupled with the fact that I realized that the decisions that people were making around content moderation were influencing what all of us see and interact with online, led me to think that it had to be an incredibly important practice.
And people do this kind of work in a variety of settings, but generally speaking, what is a normal day like? How do they go about screening all of this content?
For the human kind of frontline content moderators who are working on behalf of social media, it's usually a full day consecrated to reviewing material that has been submitted in a variety of ways. When I first started my research, that material was being reported to those moderators mostly, almost exclusively, by other users, by people like you and me. What's really changed now is that we have algorithms and other kinds of computational tools that can go out and proactively scoop up a bunch of material too. What that's done is just increase the workload. So for people who are screening the content, not only are they looking at material that may have been flagged as bad or abusive by humans, but they're also looking for false positives that might be coming through via these computational means. And typically, they are sitting in front of screens, often for 8 hours a day, reviewing piece after piece of potentially bad content. Sometimes that material is innocuous. It's, again, it's a false positive. It's a cat video, or it's from someone's wedding. But other times, it can be punctuated by some of the worst material that a person could imagine or see. And in essence, there's often really no way to predict when someone will see one or the other. And that's one of the things that makes the job hard.
And you talked with people who do this work on a daily basis. A lot of awful stuff that they come across. What kind of emotional toll did that seem to take on them?
A lot of the workers that I spoke to, they were reluctant to go into detail about any psychological impact that they may have been feeling off the bat. And that was because, as you can imagine, it's a precondition of the job to not be adversely affected by the work that you're doing. But invariably, when we would get into conversations, things would come out. They would say things to me like, you know, since I've taken this job, I found myself drinking a lot more than I used to. Or I really kind of decline a lot of social invitations that I get, because when my friends want to go out and hang out, we always talk about work, and I just don't want to tell people anything about what I'm doing. It even went to the point where one young man working in San Francisco described a situation where he was sitting with his partner on the couch, and they were kind of in an amorous moment and getting intimate, and he suddenly just pushed her away, and he said, I didn't even want to tell her why, because an image flashed in front of my eyes of something I'd seen on the job. So these impacts, sometimes they're these small moments, but you can imagine that those add up and tend to aggregate. And for me, the most worrisome thing is that we don't have any longitudinal studies or information about, you know, where will these people be in 2, 5, 10 years after they've left this workforce and they've sort of blended back into the social fabric.
You mentioned that this is, at the moment, largely an invisible job. Do we have a sense of how big this workforce is?
I like to be conservative in my estimates around that, but I think we're easily to the point where we're looking at six figures. If we even just look at some of the largest platforms that have been in the recent past more open about the numbers that they have, and that would be Facebook, Google, various properties, and so on, we know that those two firms alone are easily in the tens of thousands of workers. And that's just two platforms out of numerous platforms. So we're looking at a very large, a pretty significant, sizable global workforce that's engaged at some level in this work.
We're talking with Sarah Roberts right now, Assistant Professor of Information Studies at UCLA and the author of the new book, Behind the Screen, Exploring the Job of Moderating the Content That Gets Uploaded to the Internet. And Sarah, sites like Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter reach people all over the world, places that might have really different cultural values and laws. Did that make content moderation more of a challenge for the people you talked with?
It's absolutely a big part of the challenge in the fabric of the content moderation kind of sub industry. And this is one of the reasons why this practice has become globalized. The companies that require this moderation, as you point out, they endeavor to be global. They want the biggest audience possible. They want the whole world. And last I read the statistic about Facebook's user base alone, it's something like 87% of their user base is outside of the United States. So that suggests that in order to be effective with content moderation in these contexts, you need people who are linguistically, culturally, and also even legally oriented towards the their locale for which they are moderating. So the companies have rushed to build centers to do content moderation in these particular areas. Germany is one great example. But that's not the only reason that we see this as a global workforce. You know, getting that linguistic and cultural competency is very important for sure. But the other reason is because of a desire to kind of chase the bottom line, the lowest labor cost. And that also has meant outsourcing to places like India and the Philippines, for example.
And I imagine content that might be considered offensive in one location might not be considered as offensive in another.
That's right. And so the moderators themselves are often called on as a, again, as sort of a base function of the job they do to set aside their own cultural and national identities and embody, if you will, a set of norms that come from elsewhere, often from the United States, but not solely, and that are intended for an audience that may be, again, in another part of the world. So it's a very challenging sort of work that requires a cultural and linguistic shape-shifting, and it can often yield discomfort for the moderators. They have to follow a very strict set of rules that are developed by the platforms that they then enact, and that could be really antithetical to their own orientation to the world, but that's what the job demands.
And you note in the book that for these big social media sites, content moderation is ultimately about preserving the brand and making money. How do you see that profit motive kind of shaping the decisions about what gets allowed on the platforms?
So the profit motive, of course, is fundamental to understanding commercial content moderation. And it's fundamental really to understanding social media as a whole. And that one of the goals of the book was to try to underline this fact for readers, because I think what we need is to get to a more sophisticated understanding of what the motive is for these social media platforms to exist. I don't think that users are particularly dumb or ignorant. I count myself among them, and I don't think of myself as in that way. But I think what is actually the case is that these firms offered a very alluring opportunity to the world, which was, in fact, this used to be YouTube's tagline, broadcast yourself, express yourself, share yourself with everyone else, upload, circulate, look at other people's material. It's exciting and it's enjoyable. But the sort of profit side of that wasn't really fully unpacked and explored. And really what these companies are advertising firms. Our user-generated content is the thing that brings people to the platform, and it brings them back. It brings our eyeballs to the platform. And so that profit motive is really at the root of generating this practice of commercial content moderation. And it's the reason I argue in large part that it was kept so secret, because the firms wanted to keep their discretion about not only what to delete, but what to keep up. And those decisions were often made in terms of monetary sort of evaluations.
We'll have to leave it there. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be in Wisconsin.
That was Sarah Roberts, Assistant Professor of Information Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. She talked to Dean Kinetter, Central Time producer, earlier today about her new book. It's called Behind the Screen, content moderation in the shadows of social media. If you have had the rare opportunity to do a job like this, if you've been a content moderator, we'd love to hear your story. You can email us ideas@wpr.org. Do you ever have trouble falling asleep at night? If so, you're not alone. According to statistics, a lot of people have trouble sleeping. Sorry, I didn't take the time to dig up actual numbers on that, but trust me, it's a lot. Well, here's something maybe you can try. New research confirms that a warm bath or shower an hour or two before you go to bed can help you fall asleep faster. That's not too surprising, but here's why it works. That warm water can help cool you down. As reported by NPR, research published in the journal Sleep Medicine Reviews confirms that a warm bath helps people fall asleep faster. It works by helping us boost our body's temperature rhythm, which wants to cool us down at bedtime to help us fall asleep. But hold the phones, doesn't that warm water make us warmer? In the moment, yeah, we do feel warmer, but researchers say that warm water gets your circulation going. It brings more of your blood flowing closer to the surface of your skin. With that blood flow comes our internal body heat. It acts like a radiator, letting that heat flow out of our bodies and then helping bring our internal temperature down the 2 or 3 degrees it wants to help us sleep. There's still more work to be done on this, but in initial research, the warm water cut down the amount of time it took to fall asleep almost as much as a commonly prescribed sleep medication. Here are the specs. You just take a warm shower or bath, 10 or so minutes, an hour or two before bedtime. Let us know how it works. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.